This episode of Yes But Why Podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Download your free audiobook today at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why Podcast. Yeah.
Every year, my contemporaries look more and more like senators and Congress people. And every year I look more and more like an old catcher's mitt. You know?
But now you have a yearly professional photography record of that.
I look so much like a bulldog now.
No.
I should be allowed to pee on fire hydrants. I look totally like a bulldog. Did you go to like my website to go, who is this guy?
I did go to your website, mostly just to get the URL, but entered your bio.
Old bulldog, right?
I wouldn't say old bulldog, no.
Old bulldog. Old tired bulldog, that's me.
No. Being in theater, though, it can wear on you. I mean, you've been doing it your whole life, right? I mean, it's not, you know, it's not like one of those gigs where, you know, you end up like, that was an easy life, no problems there, nothing. Everyone opened a door for me everywhere I went. Like, this is just not how that works. I try to pretend that's what's happening to me. It's how I delude myself. It's really enjoyable.
So one of my students went on the Facey Space and took a picture of me in my 20s, I think, and showed everybody. And there was this moment where everybody, there was just dead silence. Because everybody said what happened at the same time in their head. And I said, this is a before and after picture, and the product is booze and drugs.
Oh. Do you really think so? No, I mean, like, because, like, I'm getting older, but I don't do, you know, I don't hardly ever drink. So that's why I was like, oh, is that part of it?
Well, I drank almost semi-pro 9 years ago, and I quit drinking. I haven't had booze or drugs in almost a decade. It didn't help. I look like hell. It's like I look in the mirror, and every day I just think, you should take drugs.
Would that help?
I don't know. But not taking them certainly didn't help. In gravity, that's what it is.
Oh, man. But what about your family? Like, did your family age well? You know what I mean? Like, your aunts and uncles and your dad, like, did they look older when, you know, you can generally get a clue from that kind of thing, unless you're adopted.
Yeah. No. They are still around in their late 80s and still going.
And they really look it.
They do look it, but it does. But they move very well.
Hmm?
So much so that I think to my, because I don't think I've saved enough for retirement, because both my parents look like they're going to hit 90.
Right. So you are too.
I've really only budgeted for 75. You know.
Sure. Well, where do they live?
This is either back home in Toronto.
Ah, you're Canadian. Yeah, that makes sense.
I'm both.
You're both. Both. Oh, you have dual citizenship now.
I do. Yeah, but they're back in Canada where you just go to see a doctor.
Sure. Seems nice up there. The cold air, good for the skin.
It's this crazy system where you don't feel well, you go to the doctors. Whereas here, you don't feel well, and you Google it, and you go online and figure out if it's covered. And then doctors in New York, by the way, you say, can I see you? Because I have a real pain in my side. And they go, yeah, I can see you in a month.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you go, well, what if it kills me? I say, well. But they're in great shape. They're really, they do wonderfully.
Yeah, well, that's you then. I mean, though New York, you were saying it's a bit more of a wearing town. It certainly is. I mean, I don't know how much experience you have with Austin, but Austin's definitely a magical wonderland, certainly comparatively. But I mean, I love New York. It's just, you know, it's a heavy weight upon you that you live with.
It is. Sometimes you just kind of, you're there and you're going, is everybody trying to kill me?
Yeah.
And you have to remember that people aren't really mad at you. Sometimes they use the term bonehead as a compliment.
Sure. Sure. That's what they do.
Sarcasm. It's actually how they show love.
You know what, though? You're from Toronto, so your experience of it is in comparison to that. I'm from Boston.
Right.
Okay.
Oh my
Boston,
God.
The rough, angry streets of Boston. So when I moved to New York after high school or college and stuff, but I was like, everyone's so nice in New York. Oh,
yeah.
Wow. People are so friendly. And the people are like, what? What are you talking about? Like, oh, I'm used to Boston. Like, I went to college in Texas for 4 years and then came back, went to the train station and asked customer service to help me. And the woman was all like, I'm not here to help you. And I wanted to be like, that is literally your whole job. But you can't do that in Boston. You just go, yes, and walk away. So New York City is like, you know, Oz to me. It was like a wonderland of people. Hello, how are you? I shook hands with everyone. There were musical numbers. That's what it was like for me.
My experience was, so in Toronto, we're all very polite, but we are not very warm. We're not huggy people. We're very polite. We please and thank you very much so, but we're not sharing. And in New York, they are very warm, but they ain't polite. So you know what a New Yorker thinks about you in the first second. I had a map once back in the days of maps, and a guy comes over and grabs the map from me and says, where are you going? I want to help. And I go, I'm going. As soon as I said, he says, come on, where are you going? Where are you going? And then he shoves the map back in my hand and says, if you don't know where you're going, I can't help you, and walks away.
That's the most New York thing I've ever heard.
That's amazing. Or my very first time to New York, I was in my late 20s, and I was researching a show that I was writing about Red Skelton.
Yeah, you were.
It was before the internet.
Sure.
And so I came to New York, and I was going to the Museum of Television and Radio, and I was watching the old Red Skelton shows and transcribing his pantomime routines. And then I would go when it closed at 4, and then I would go and I'd find, you know, the subway goes down a flight of stairs, but there's a flat part,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's got a wall so people don't fall in.
Mm-hmm.
I'd set up there and I'd take the transcriptions and I'd kind of work them through in my body because I was going to be doing them. And a guy comes walking by and he goes, hey, it's Red Skelton. And he reaches into his pocket and pulls out some money. And as I'm saying, no, I'm just using this for free rehearsal space, he gets right up in my face and screams, I'm not going to give you any money if you don't have a hat, you fucking idiot. I'm trying to go, and, you know, I'm from Toronto. I'm stuttering. I don't even, somebody's screaming at your face. I'm going, I'm not. He's like, fuck you, and walks away.
Oh, my my God. Oh, wow.
So that being said, even though I work, I work in Manhattan. I ran out of money a few years ago, and I live in New Jersey, which is one third the price of Manhattan. I can get into Midtown in 15 minutes. I can see the Empire State Building from my backyard. But when I leave New York, it's this palpable, like every day I go through the tunnel, and on the other side, it's like, living there was a nightmare because it's 24/7. If you're not partying till 3 o'clock in the morning, you have no place living in that town.
Yeah, it's true.
Because it doesn't shut down till 3-4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
So yeah, I jumped the river at that point.
Do you get some nature in your home in New Jersey now?
I do. That's nice. There's some grass, and there's a river behind our place.
Ooh.
I know. So there's a duck every now and then. They're coughing because everything's polluted. But
sure. Sad ducks, but ducks nonetheless.
Sad ducks.
It's the name of the pond, but people don't talk about it. The sad duck pond.
Duck pond.
It's, realtor stopped using that phrase a while back.
Welcome to the coughing duck. Can I take your order, please? That'd be a great name for a restaurant, the Coffin Duck. I'm writing that down.
Yeah, because it sounds like there's a story there, and then no one can tell the story, and then it becomes more exciting. So, like, no one will ever tell me what that's about.
I think it's the name of Coffin Duck. We can't. I can't say. And then you look over your shoulder, like somebody could be listening. Should have been recording this. This should be it. This should have been the whole thing.
This is it. I'm recording it right now. It's already happening.
Oh, thank God.
Don't worry. We're a few minutes in. I've been taking notes consistently. No kidding.
Oh, good. Okay, cool.
Yeah. So now I'm going to jump into more like interviewee kind of stuff though. So
sure.
We can still be fun, but I just wanted you to know, I'm going to ask you a question now.
No more of this friendship stuff. Go on.
No, we can be friendly. It's totally fine. I'm just going to also say, hey, part of our friendship is me finding out more about how you got into comedy. Remember those parents that are never going to die? It's going to be great. Tell me what they did that got you into comedy. Were they terrible or great?
A little column A, a little column B. No, I'm a funny family. I'm not actually the funniest brother.
Oh.
I'm probably the least funny brother. I have my parents are funny. My mother's extremely funny. They had two boys, Mike and Rick. It's National Sibling Day on the day that we recorded this, by the way. So I sent them a picture of me hitting myself in the face, saying 54 years later, I still don't know why I'm hitting myself in the face. Because my brothers were 7 and 8 years old when I was born.
Oh.
Because my parents decided to try to have a girl. Let's try to have a girl. And they were they didn't even have, they said, let's have a girl. They picked out a girl's name. It was 1965, by the way. So the girl's name was Dawn, D-A-W-N, like Tony Orlando, and Dawn was the big music act at the time. So they were going to have a girl and call her Dawn. And so I was the only planned child. They do this, and they get to the hospital, and a boy comes out because, you know, genetics. And because my dad's 6.5 feet tall, alpha male, firefighter. There's no way.
Well, and also in the 60s, you can't, like, decide to have a guy or a girl. I mean, you can't do that now.
Right.
But
and they didn't know until I popped out. And so they realized they did not have a name. Now, you and I, as improvisers would say, you know, Don is actually phonetically pretty good guy's name. And I would have rocked Don Hope. I would be a great Don Hope. But instead, my mother said, okay, this is the last chance we have to name one of the children after you. My dad's real name is Arnold, but he goes by Mitch because he hates Arnold. And so he says, no, no. And they get into a big fight in the hospital. And they come and they say, have you named the baby for the birth certificate? And they say, no. And they're not speaking to each other. So they put the name Baby Watson on my original certificate to send me home. So I came home as Baby Watson, which I would like to point out, I also would have rocked that name.
You would have been a gangster, right now, though. It would have been a much different life.
It would be amazing. I'm right now talking to Baby Watson, and I would just be that guy. But no, they were fighting, and my brother Rick, the one that's 7 years older than I am, goes, he's in class, and so the teacher says, hey, you have a new baby in the family. What's the baby's name? And he says, Baby. Like, they were referring to me as Baby. He says, Baby, and tells them the story that my parents are fighting about the name. So the teacher gets all the kids to put names in hats and then puts together a chart and has them vote to teach them about democracy. And the name Scott won, and she sent a letter home to my parents, and they went, fine, good enough. People say, are you named after anybody? I said, named by Democratic vote.
Of children.
Yeah.
You could have been named Tiger.
I could have been Farty McFartface.
It totally would have been your name.
Which
I could just
I
see your parents
blocked.
Like, fine. And they just write Farty McFartface.
They both saw a way out of the fight. So that was it. So
you would become a lawyer, and your name would be FM Watson. That's
right?
That's what you'd be your name.
So there was no chance. There was zero possibility I wasn't going to go into comedy.
Oh, because you already started out with receiving suggestions, and the first thing you did in life was take a suggestion. That's humongous.
Right? I like that. I love that you said that. That's terrific. I love that.
You can take it. Tell everyone it.
Oh,
oh my God, that's so funny. Oh, I love it. And I also enjoy that you're like, I'm not even the funniest brother. Well, too bad for them. Well, they sell insurance. It doesn't matter. You're still the one in comedy. Is everybody else still live in Canada and you're living in NYC?
They are. They're all in Canada. Cold.
Sure. I hear that. I mean, it's not like warm in New York City, though.
No, that's true. But the 500-mile difference actually does make a difference because
I also live far away from my family.
Oh, gee, it's so good. Isn't it great?
It's great.
Because you can go and you visit them, and it's special, and it's not like you again.
Yeah, I'm fancy.
And were you the one that moved?
Yeah.
Or did they abandon you somewhere?
No. I'm from Boston, so they're just all still in Boston, and I live in Texas.
Right. So it's up to you to be the one to keep in contact and keep with all your friends in Boston, because you're the one that left. Now, if it was, you know, the whole family was in Texas, and then your parents retired to Boston. God, no one has ever done that. But if they ever did, then it would be up to them. So I kind of take on the responsibility. I'm the one that moved 500 miles away, so I got to reach out and make sure I'm doing stuff with them.
Sure, I guess. That sounds good. I don't do that. I should probably start.
Well, it does help.
That's probably why I don't talk to them.
Oh,
it's my problem.
Let's talk. So is that why you're in comedy?
No.
Because of the terrible?
No, they're not terrible. They're just, I don't know, we don't hang out. We don't really talk. My mom's always been very like, yeah, I'll talk to you later. It's fine. Like, we used to joke that she, you know, you'd be on the phone with her, and if she was on the phone with you for more than 5 minutes, there was something real wrong.
Oh.
Like, she'll have a full conversation with you in 5 minutes, and then she's like, all right, I'll talk to you later. Right. And that's fine. I'm enough. And my sister and I, we just don't click. We talk occasionally. We have a nice long, hour-long conversation once every 6 months, sometimes 3 years, you know. It's different lives.
Let me ask you this, because you don't have a Bostonian accent, do they? Like, or did
yes.
you went and go into the arts? So
I always knew I was going to be in... I always knew that I was going to be in theater, and I felt that it was important not to have a Boston accent, so I tried not to have one.
Oh, okay. So this is we need to talk about this.
Okay.
Because in theater school, I did 4 years in a pretty good theater school in Canada, and one of the first things they did was remediate our Canadian accents. And I have – my family talks like Bob and Doug McKenzie. Like, that's what they sound like. And that's what I sound like. I don't even know if I can do it, but I talk down in here.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a lot different, eh? I'm not even doing it right. So it's a weird thing when you go into the arts and you say, I'm going to speak differently. And then your family, you speak differently than your family.
Hmm. Yeah.
It can be disturbing for both, he said, psychoanalyzing suddenly.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't know that my family always knew I was going to be doing performance too. So I think they just assumed the same. You know, it was just like, well, you know, you can't have an accent when you do plays. Because my uncle did plays, and I did plays because he did. Like, he was the guy I wanted to be. So I went and did exactly what he did. You know. So he has an accent a little bit, even though he lives in L.A. now, but he still has a bit of a Boston accent. But that's his charm. I'm not that guy.
Right. I'm not that guy.
Well, like, ladies with Boston accents, no one's ever like, ah, yes, that woman is going to play a wonderful mother in this television show. Or, ah, yes, she represents all womankind in this commercial about Geico. Whatever.
It's like, Boston!
Yeah.
Here!
Well, yeah, it's, yeah.
A Canadian accent, everybody loves Canadians. Everybody loves Canadians. But when you have a really thick Northern Ontario Canadian Bob and Doug McKenzie accent, people do tend to slow things down for you a little bit. It's like, do you understand? Oh, yeah. I have a degree in this, eh? Oh, that's so cute. He's got a degree.
I didn't know they had colleges in Canada. You're adorable. Did you come down here to go to college? Was it like extra intense for you?
Yes, it moved very quickly.
I can't imagine that people say that stuff to you anymore, you know, harass you about like, man, New York City must be crazy. I don't know what accent I'm doing right there.
That's a great one.
I have no, I'm terrible at doing accents. I can just not do a Boston accent. That's my extent of accents. But, you know, as far as people don't talk down to you now. You don't have an accent, but also like if people find out from you're from Canada, they don't give you a hard time, do they?
They do a little, not a hard time, but it's a little bit like you've just told somebody that you're related to teddy bears. Oh, yeah, I'm from a long line of teddy bears. And they go, oh, isn't that nice? Like, they rub your belly. It's like, oh, you're Canadian. How nice. You're so harmless. It's kind of true. It's kind of true.
Hey, man, you know, they stop having attractive leaders. That's all I'm saying. Like, just quit it. Quit it. I don't want to look at them.
Okay. So, you got to look up his father when his father was young.
Was he also
Justin,
attractive?
Oh, he was nummy. And Justin, I'll give you, he's a good-looking guy. and he's smart, liberal, and he's well spoken, and he's got, you know. But his dad, there was Pierre Trudeau, he was prime minister like through my entire childhood, because we don't have 4-year term limits.
Because
the prime minister isn't as powerful. They're just not as powerful. They're just the leader of one side of the of parliament. It's not that big a deal.
kind of sounds like a big deal.
He and his wife spent a couple of days in bed with John and Yoko.
during
bed peace, and they had an open relationship, and Maggie Trudeau there was talk that she was sleeping with Mick Jagger, and Pierre was jet set. Oh yeah, they were swingers.
Oh, so is Justin's dad Mick Jagger?
He looks so much like his old man. I don't think so. But we had a thing called Trudeau Mania. Everybody was just crazy for this guy.
So wait, how did his son become prime minister again? Is there a lot of nepotism? Is it a monarchy? I didn't think it was a monarchy. No.
It is.
No.
It's now officially a monarchy. No.
Oh, I was like, wait, it's not, right? I don't know.
He's a really smart, accomplished guy. And again, when it's not that big a deal, unlike here, where it's an incredibly big deal. So
oh, yeah.
That important, who is unlike here.
Technically, it's not as big a deal, but we make it a bigger deal.
Because,
like, technically, it's not, but they're letting it. Like, I'm like, who's the guy who's in charge for real? Who can be like, hey, man, back. Like, hey. Donnie,
it's getting to be. It's really getting to be. It's not. It's not even just him. For the last 20 years, it's that position is becoming more and more important, and not in a good way.
Mm-hmm. Did you see Vice?
No, I haven't. But I have it in my queue.
Okay, well, all I'm saying is what you're saying right now is exactly what it's about.
Well, don't tell me how it ends.
I won't. Except for to tell you that I didn't realize that Dick Cheney wasn't dead. Turns out, not dead.
But he's got an external heart.
I don't care. He's alive, and he can high-five someone that Christian Bale played him in the movie, okay?
But he actually carries around machinery that's keeping him alive, like his heart and lungs he is Darth freaking Vader.
I'll be Darth freaking Vader if Beyonce plays me in the movie. Okay? You know what I mean? Like,
okay,
Christian Bale is so good and, like, just does such a good, like, in your life, if you had someone play you and, like, so right now in the world in movies, I would say Christian Bale's probably like tip top of like people who really are going to give who you are as a character in life a once over,
right.
You know, like complete, you know, some actors you're like, eh, I mean, he looked like him, but I don't know. Like Sam Rockwell played W. Was he everything I needed him to be? No, but it's okay. Doesn't matter. It wasn't about him.
Yeah, I love Sam Rockwell.
Oh, me too. Me too. You ever worked with him there in NYC?
No.
Okay.
I've got...
I don't know. He does plays and stuff. Now, tell me, when you got to, you went to theater school in Canada, you said, where they removed your accent and they made you a great actor. What happened then? Like, where did you go? What was your next step? As far you're like, I've got a theater degree, like all of us, you know. And then you stepped out of the school doors, and you were like, "All right, make me a star." And then what happened?
So can I actually have to jump back
Oh, please.
Because, so I started taking Second City classes at 16.
Oh, in so Toronto?
Maybe a little bit before. So I had taken Second City classes from 16 to 19. I had essentially done all of the levels, and in those days, the teachers of the Second City courses in Toronto were, like, I was working with the director of the main stage show, Sandra Bulkowski, and then so it was like you were really connected to them. And then I went off to university. Sorry. It's called to a theater school. And
what university did you go to?
York University.
Oh.
It's an offshoot of U of T. But then now it's kind of its own thing. It's got a really good program. I got accepted into York, and it was close to home. Anyway, went to a pretty good school, and then I came out and I really wanted to act. You know.
Did you get a theater degree from York University, or did you get something?
I have a Bachelor of Fine Arts in Theater, yeah.
Good.
My wife was my theater history teacher, so she has a master's degree in, it's not as sorted as you think. She taught me, and I was a very bad student. On the other line. I know. I wish it was more sorted.
No, it's fine.
She taught me I was a bad student, and she didn't really like me very much. And then we both got cast in a play together, and then we started a relationship after. Not that it matters, just many years later. But then, so I worked as an actor, as I like to call it, masturbating in the hay. You know, doing serious acting, fall down on your face and bleed and cry stuff. And then somewhere along the line, I think it was Sandra Bulkowski over at Second City Toronto said, "Are you ever coming back? Because we're talking about doing a conservatory program where you'd come and do a show, and then that'd possibly be a way to get hired." And I went, yeah. So I came and I did a conservatory show and then got hired right out of there. And then toured around Canada for long enough. But
one of the first Second City Torcos.
Yeah, the Canadian National Touring Company.
Yeah.
We'd go up north in the winter because that's when we were needed. Oh my God, it's cold. You don't really understand. You don't get cold until your nostrils freeze together.
I mean, I'm from Boston, so I have had a bit of it. I haven't had it in a long, long time, but you know, I grew up with some snow, some coldness. I mean, you're right, Canadian tundra, different. But
well, yeah, they'd send us up to Timmins, which is pretty far north, and. Cool. Can I tell them a slightly off color story?
100%. Yeah. All the colors are acceptable.
And it's so cold, and we're miles from nowhere, and I really needed to pee, and I got out, and they said, "Oh, just pee because you're in the middle of nowhere. Nobody's going to drive by." So they stopped. It wasn't even the side of the road. There's snowbanks. You're stopped in the road, and I get out, and I'm peeing on the road, and the urine freezes as soon as it touches the road and turns into a little pee volcano. And I brought everybody out. I said, "You have to see this." And people were like, we tried to mention it in the show that night.
Oh,
people
my
were like,
God.
Oh, yeah. What do you think pee happens to pee in February in you know,
oh, my God.
Sault Ste. Marie?
A little too much truth, not enough comedy.
Right. I don't see the joke.
You know what's funny about that particular concept, actually, when I'm teaching comedy these days, because the world is such a crazier place than it used to be, like, if only just because now we like have access to all the weirdness, like now it's like, wait, what, that's a thing? And it's a thing. Every time I'm talking about writing comedy, I was like, okay guys, you have to try to make it crazier than real life. I will accept real life in the first and second beats, but the third beat better not exist. If I Google it and it's real, it's not third beat enough. I need something so wild, it's never going to happen. Because things are just so super crazy now, right? It's super hard to do that. And I love it because you're right. The audience will legit call you on that. They'll be like, nah, happened to me yesterday. Not comedy.
Yep.
Next. You're that's like, okay.
A, that's just a thing. Doing a thing.
Oh, man. So you're going on tour in the tundra. You're peeing and telling everybody about it. It's a good time. It was a good time.
The second city ended, as the second city always ends.
That's what I hear.
The second city is like a child with a balloon. It always ends in tears. Always. I see parents and they give kids a balloon and I go, that's, you're just going to say, this is just like saying, so we'll take this home. It'll pop. You'll cry for 17 hours and that's how we're going to end our day. So,
I mean,
city,
do you have any kids? That's kind of how they react to everything. It's like hard to like.
I have fastidiously avoided children because they're sticky. I don't like, I'm tactile. I don't like that feeling on my hands.
I hear you. I spend most of my life right now just wiping off my child.
Oh, yeah. That's why you need a dog.
No.
Then
I have to clean up after the dog too? No.
No, they're cleaner than people. You just have the dog lick the child and you're done. Hey, if you get the right kind of dog, they'll even eat the shit.
Too far. See, that was a third beat right there.
But it's true.
I don't care.
That's just a thing.
Fine. I won't accept it.
They're disgusting.
Super
gross. About them.
So second city's over, you're crying.
Right. So then I
in a good way or a bad way? Like I'm gonna miss you or like screw you guys. Which one?
It was that last one. But I think it was mutual.
Sure.
You know, I now that I'm older and I have more experience, I probably would have fired me too. Especially since when I left there, I started producing because there's no other way to get paid to do sketch comedy and improv other than either being with one of the very few theaters that do it or do it yourself, because it's a completely viable product when it's out for sale and people do buy it. So I did that and I learned a great deal about what an asshole I was. And then
is this in Toronto that you're doing this sketch comedy show on your own? What was the name of the show?
Yeah. I did the long running one was called Comedy on Rye with a WRY. And that was a very successful sketch comedy troupe in Canada. We toured around a lot. And I did a bunch of different projects. There was one called From Toronto From Z to A. Which was a show that did really well in downtown Toronto. And then acting gigs, you know, I'm somewhere in there. I said, I don't want to do any serious acting anymore. I put on my resume that I'm a light comic actor.
Were you doing plays or films or what? Did you have an agent?
Yes. I had both of all of those things. I did plays and films and lots of TV commercials. And what's hilarious, we have in Canada, we have this thing called the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation.
Yeah.
And it's our national network. And it's a pretty cool thing, but for whatever reason, when I said, I only want to do things that are funny now. I don't want to cry anymore because it's too hard on my soul. And I love comedy, so that's and that's what I'm known for. So when I put it on my resume saying, look, I'm a light comic actor, so for whatever reason the CBC only would cast me in serious roles from that point on. I played cops, I played scientists, I played doctors, everybody's dying, everybody's been murdered. And the casting, like everybody knew who the casting people were, and I went, I We do comedy at the CBC. Why am I not in any of the comedy? And they trotted out that old chestnut. Oh, you know, comedians are the best actors.
Oh.
And I'm like, they're also the best comedians.
Not to mention the fact that it's like, why are you bringing that up when I say I'm not doing comedy? What are you trying to say?
Well, you know, when you rarefy something, when you say somebody can't have something, that's when they want it.
Oh, sure.
And I'm a child like that. If you tell me that I'm not allowed to pee, I gotta, right? As soon as you say, don't go in the kitchen, I think of 10 things I have to do in the kitchen. So I think that happened. And then I kind of bumped my head on the ceiling in Canada. So somewhere along the line, I was doing a lot of television commercials. There I was able to do some comedy and a lot of plays. But I'm doing these television commercials, and my agent calls me and says, okay, so I just got a breakdown that said they want a Scotty Watson type. And that's when you know you've reached a place, because an actor's career goes, who the hell is Scotty Watson? Get me Scotty Watson. Get me a young Scotty Watson type. And then the last one, who the hell is Scotty Watson?
That right there is your one-man show. That's like your career one-man show. That's what that is.
Yeah. So when that happened, I went, it's time to get the hell out of Dodge.
Yeah.
And I was already kind of connected with a New York theater company called Artistic New Directions, now called Ant Theater. And Michael Gelman, who had directed in Toronto and he's the professor emeritus over at Second City Chicago. So he hired me to do Second City NYC to teach improv and advanced sketch writing. And that was my first job in New York. So there I am. I'm back at the Second City again. I was at the Second City when I was 16. I was at the Second City when I was 23. And I was at the Second City when I was 41.
What year is this that when you moved to New York City?
Do you want to say 12 years ago?
Well, you just said you were 41. So should I do the math? Or?
My math is terrible. I would have been.
Oh my God, I don't know how old you are.
Early 40s, 12 years ago. I'm 50. Actually, last Friday I turned 54.
Oh, happy birthday!
Yeah, thank you. It's such a nothing age. How old are you? 54. Oh,
actually,
that's all you get.
Okay. I do this every time. I feel like, okay, I've decided I got to write a book about this because I bring it up every single podcast, but it's coming up.
Okay.
Get ready, audience.
Okay.
Okay. So you are at the end and or potentially the beginning of your next cycle. Okay. I have a theory that we all become new people every 18 years. Why 18? Well, because that block is kind of ingrained in us as children. From 0 to 18, we're with our parents, right? We have to learn from them. We have to do what they say. We live with them. They take care of us. And, you know, we're trying to figure out who we are and what's going on and what we want to do and, like, what our journey is. And then by the time we're 18, people are like, all right, great. You ready to make a decision about what the next few years of your life are? And by next few years, we mean forever, right? So at that point, you become a new person. From 18 to 36, you become adult you. You get to be who you are on your own. You make decisions without your parents. You have problems without your parents. You, like, figure out how to fix stuff when it goes wrong. You figure out how to have relationships and move in and move out and have jobs and all the things. By the time you're 36, you've gone through all of the things, one hopes, right? So then at 36, you kind of get itchy. You're like, what am I doing? Who am I? What's happening? I'm not 25. Oh, I'm not 70. Oh, what do I do now? Right? So everyone gets itchy. Some people buy cars. Some people get divorced. Some people move. They, you know, whatever it is, they got to change their lives. They got to become someone new. And then there's the next one, 36 to 54. So your living in New York City was your third cycle. The whole experience of your New York City life is your third cycle. It was the, you used the lessons that you learned in your first cycle and your second cycle to be the person, but you know, you're a different person. I mean, if 36-year-old you talked to 18-year-old you, those are different people. They're different people. And if 54-year-old you talks to 36-year-old you, totally different. You'd be like, oh, man, you will figure some stuff out soon. Relax, bud. Don't worry. You know, whatever it is. So I think because we live a lot longer than we used to, right? Like your parents, they're in their, you know, 90s and stuff. They're on their, let's see. So 54 plus 18, oh God, math is hard. 72, right? So they're on like their fifth cycle. To keep life interesting, to like maintain who, like a journey of life, you really have to reinvent yourself in some way. And some of us, you and me, I can tell we have a similar drive to be in theater. We want to do this stuff. This is the things we want to do. But like how we do it doesn't matter to me. I'm fine. Improv seems fun. I've had a great time with improv. Improv, for me, it has been mostly the latter half of my second cycle. I only learned what improv was when I was 30. I didn't know what it was before that. Right. So for years and years, I was doing sad plays like you. And and then all of a sudden it was like, hey, did you know you could have funsies up on stage? Just a little make 'em ups. And it's super fun. Good times all the time. Yeah. I mean, if I had known. But anyway, so with reference to this thing, my idea of the cycle is essentially a way to give yourself a break. You're always in a cycle. And you're at different points in your own development, right? So a lot of the times that you feel less than or you don't know what you're doing with your life or like you're like, what am I doing? That can generally be chalked up to being in a specific point in your journey. And I feel like a lot of times we make dumb decisions because we feel trapped. But it's like, no, just reinvent yourself. Like you moved to New York City. That's amazing. You moved to a different country. That's huge, right? That's as big as a guy going, I'm selling my Toyota Tundra and I'm buying a Miata. I'm divorcing my wife and I'm dating this 25-year-old. Like they want something new in their lives. And people like, that's another thing too. I always feel bad for people that don't have, like it's great that some people have a lot of money making whatever job that they do. But I love theater so much that when people don't have a thing that's like theater in their life, I like feel bad. Like, I'm like, oh, don't you like anything? What do you like? You know, cause a lot of people just work cause they think that's what they're supposed to do. Right. And that's, those people are very prone to be affected by this cycle stuff because life is goal oriented. And if you don't feel like there's a new goal, what are you going to be like? If you're not working toward 36-year-old you, then what happens? And when you turn 36, like when I turned 36 was right when I found out that I was pregnant or right after that. Oh. And so I was like, oh, I guess I'm a mom now. I guess that's what I do.
Wow.
So my third cycle is mom. And it's 18 years, right? So it's his first cycle.
First cycle.
When he moves out and goes to college or gets a job or whatever, I'm in my next cycle. I'm in the next, who am I? What am I doing? Think about it even with reference to people who like get married right after college. So they go to college, great. They're 21, they meet somebody. Literally 70% of the people that I know that they did that. I mean, most of the people I know are on their second or third marriage, you know what I mean? But like sometimes they get married and they have kids. And then from after college to now, they're just raising kids. I was doing other theater stuff. You were doing other theater stuff. but they were raising kids. So for when they turn 40, they're like, oh, who am I? What? My kid's in college now. What am I supposed to do? Who's this person I'm married to? Like all sorts of stuff, you know? I just think we should give ourselves like a break to be on a journey and to allow ourselves to become someone new. And also to think of yourself in the way you would like a child. Like, so I'm 40 right now. So I'm 4 years into my third cycle. I'm at home with the baby a lot. I don't really know what I'm doing, like, theatrically very much in my life right now. Right. But I'm trying to be cool because I'm like, you're 4 years old. It's fine. 4-year-olds don't know what they're doing. 4-year-olds don't know what they want to study in college. 4-year-olds don't know anything. Relax. So I want to give myself a break. Be like, it's fine. Sometimes you are totally on, like, everything's going great. You're doing exactly what you should be doing. And that's usually in the midsection, right? I mean, we all remember being like 12 to 17. Great times, great times, great times. I learned so much. I did so many cool things. Yeah, I took chances. Yeah. So, you know, anyway, that's, I literally talk about it every single pod. Like, this podcast is called Yes, But Why, but realistically it should be called Amy's 18-Year Theory because, like, I bring it up every time. Every time.
I think that's a, well, what a great way to come at an interview, though, is, look, I have this theory. So when we talk about this stuff, we're going to put it through this lens. It's a framework. It's really a cool thing to think about.
Well, I mean, also, I really just think, I mean, when I created this podcast, too, it was with an eye to students, with an eye to people who, like you and I, who went, got a theater degree, and then were like, what the hell am I going to do with my life? Like, thank you for this paper, this expensive piece of paper. What happens now? And nobody knows, right? So I interview people that do theater and do performance or do writing or directing, casting, all the different possible ways you can be involved in it. You got a theater degree? Right. Here's 1,000 jobs you could potentially have.
Yeah. Oh, it's so, that is incredibly true.
So, but, I mean.
That is, yeah. It's one of those. It's one of those skill sets that you can turn to anything. It's they call it soft skills in business, and I'm like, bullshit.
Oh yeah,
they are absolutely necessary skills. You know, how do
they
you
mean it like software though?
Do they?
They I mean it like mean software because there's hardware and there's software. And like, so like hardware is your physical, is the physical computer itself, right? So like my body's hardware is my heart, right? It's inside, it's taken part of my brain. So the soft skills are like software. Like you have to put in Windows to your computer for it to function. So my soft skills, my software, I taught myself theater 12.0 and now I do it. So it's, they don't mean it negatively. I know you think that they mean something mean about soft skills, but they don't.
Well,
the only
reason I say that, everybody can take things one way or another. There's certain terms that are dangerous terms to use, like cost centers.
Hmm.
I have often heard people in business refer to people as cost centers.
No.
And you go, they're the means of production. Because I can use the term too. Mine's coming from Karl Marx, which is going to scare the hell out of you. But, right? What you call a cost center, I call the means of production. And what they call, you know, they would consider a hard skill like negotiating. And I'd say, well, technically, all skills are skills. There's a real danger in putting in certain terminologies. I just wrote this ranting blog. I left the blog, by the way. somebody put this meme out there that said, when, you know, when you're buying art from an artist, you're buying all the pain and experience that went into it, and all that. And I, let me stop you for a second here. And so, you're paying for all these things. And I'm saying you're using terms that belittle your own work. The price of art is what the market will bear. And you don't have to explain to a capitalist any more than that. Why is this so expensive? Because I can get it.
Yeah.
Right? Rather than you have to pay for my pain. This is my experience and my it belittle, you know, language is so important that way.
Plus, I think you're right in that the capitalist way in which we like live our lives, like, and that money is the most important thing, certainly can cause some trouble for when people are trying to get paid for doing artistic work, because people think they are, in a negative way, quote unquote, soft skills. They think they don't have to pay as much for them because, like you're saying with this other person, they're like, oh, well, this guy's just going to spend it on, you know, drugs so that he can do another painting. Or, oh, well, these people, they don't understand the world. That's why they have to do this theater stuff. And you're like, yeah, okay, I didn't invent capitalism. I just happen to live in a country that's the main thing that keeps everything going. Like, art is art. I would be doing art in any country, in any government, in any situation. Yeah. It just happens that in this particular one, I'm not trying to get more money than I deserve. You're right. What will the market bear? I have conversations on improv, like Facebook groups all the time, where people are like, how much should I charge for this? And then a bunch of us say like really high numbers and they're like, whoa, that's a lot. And we're like, yeah. And you are going to charge what we tell you to, because the rest of us are charging this much. And if you go lower, then they're going to think that it's worth less, and it's not. And we like break down why. It's like, yeah, it looks like a lot, but this is what it breaks down into. You know,
there was a troupe in Toronto called 500 Miles Off Broadway. they were a wonderful troupe. They'd been together for a long time, and they really believed in community. One of the reasons why I went into improv when I was 16, because when I was 15, I was touring with a rock and roll band doing stand up. I know. I was underage in the places that we were playing. And
what?
And I got in with the other stand-ups, and I went, They're weird. They're terrible people. And improv was like a community, because you do it as a group. So 500 Miles Off Broadway, they were doing these shows at the Pilot Tavern. And everybody went to see their shows because they brought people up, and it was just a great big puppy pile of improv love. And they invited us all for pancakes. They said, tomorrow morning, we're going to have pancakes right here, and we're going to talk about what we charge, because some people are undercutting everybody else. And do you know what we charge? And we sat down and everybody just said their number, and people were shocked. And like, I get, you know, you want to get $500 to teach a class or something when you're starting out. That's what that's for. You know, you bid low when you're first starting out because you don't have the experience, right? You are getting what you pay for. But they had brought in all the troops that should be the premium number troops. And it was a shock, and it wasn't in any way price fixing. It was just, here's the information. This is what we charge. This is what you can get. This is what you are worth. You know, so.
Yeah, it's really important to know what you're worth in that situation.
Because when I'm doing my little thingy things going around, I just say my number.
Yeah, I've gotten very used to accepting no. Like, it's like, they're like, I can't afford that. And I'm like, okay.
I will give them the name of somebody who will work for that.
I don't.
Because I have students. You know, I have
good luck to you. Bye bye.
Generation of good luck. Good luck with that. I have generations of students, and some of them, that number is going to make their rent. And so I'm 100%. And one of the reasons that I do that is when they actually have some money in their pocket, they will come. They'll come back. Because they'll work with your student and they'll have a great time. They'll go, that person was amazing. And one of the things that when I'm teaching, I tell people to, you know, quote your sources, because when I say something that Gary Austin said, I will say, you know, I'll actually imitate the people. I'll imitate Gary Austin saying something that he would say. But one of my favorite things he said to me as an actor, I wasn't with the Groundlings, by the way. This was here in New York. He was doing some stuff, and he goes, I kind of stopped for a moment, and I was ruminating, and he said, "Just move to where your next line is." Move to where your next line is. What the? And I just moved my body. I physically moved my body. There was my next line. Or, you know, Michael Gelman. I think I had already mentioned. He was another one that was seminal. If I say something that Michael has said, I will quote that thing. I have a little book. It's available on Amazon. Scotty's Improv Tips, but they're not me. I've said something that Michael Gelman has said, and I said Michael Gelman said that, and I was in a class. David Rozowski, like keep your inventory small, specific, and important. That's David Rozowski. You know, and so if you quote those people and you teach your students to quote those people, then everybody feels like they're part of a longer thing that goes back in time and back in time. And then when they teach, they say, Scotty Watson taught me this. And so people who can't spend a lot of money on a workshop or for whatever it is, they start hearing these names. Well, who's Gary Austin? Who's David Rozowski? Who's Carol Fox Prescott, an amazing teacher for breath and voice? Who's Scotty Watson? And all the boats rise when that happens. So that's why I will absolutely do a reference. For you need somebody for $50? I got somebody for $50.
Yeah, well, it's a different kind of world when you're talking about with, you know, students of the craft versus like corporate events and stuff. I'm usually trying to hardline the corporate events. I'm a lot more easygoing about doing art. I'm like, okay, well, can your troupe pay me $5 each? What do you think? Yeah. But so you're at, when you move to New York City for your third cycle, you're in New York City. You started teaching at Second City, New York, and you were teaching improv and sketch writing. Were you, were the sketch writing stuff that you were teaching, I guess all of it, were you just teaching, was it like they hand you a syllabus and you just teach what you were taught? Is it basic classes like that? Or is there like a leeway? Are they like, hey, you're good at sketches, so you teach your thing, but for sketch writing? How does it work for you?
So I had a completely different experience with Second City NYC than anybody's ever had with the Second City, because there was an administrator back in Chicago that messed something up. There was supposed to be a level 0, 1, 2, and 3. I was 3. I was supposed to be advanced. So there's supposed to be 4 levels. And the administrator gave the first person the level 1 syllabus. So level 0 never got taught.
Oh.
Next person, and it goes progressive. Like it's your, we had enough students to do level 1 the first week, 2 the first year, right? So by the time they got to me, I went to the person teaching the class before me, which was supposed to be a level 2 class, and they were teaching what was in my syllabus. And I And I watched, and then I went to the improv side, and they were teaching what I'm supposed to be teaching. And so I went to Michael, and I said, because Michael Gelman was the artistic director at Second City NYC, I said, hey, it appears that the syllabuses have gotten screwed up. And then we went through it and went, yeah, they sent level zero to level one. And so, yeah, we're out. I said, okay, that's no big deal. I'm supposed to be three, but they're teaching three now. Can you send me four? And the Second City said, no, for four, they have to come and study in Chicago at the Second City.
Ah.
So what do you want me to do? And there was this hang time, and Gelman said, you guess you better create a syllabus. So I went to some places that I really believed in. I went the style of improv that I teach has zero to do with what they teach at the Second City now. I went back to Jeffrey Sweet's book, Something Wonderful, right away. And I'm happy to say I'm friends with Jeffrey now. But I read what Elaine May said about improv, that there's three basic principles. You make active and positive choices. You support the physical and verbal reality of the scene. And it's an actor's job to justify. When things go wrong, you fix it. And it's as simple as that. And it's not rules. It's these positive principles, because a lot of the improv stuff changed because it to accommodate 20-something-year-old white males swinging their penises around. And we lost the fact that all of this came, like Viola Spolin. That's where it came from at the Second City. This is supposed to be something that has been created by women, and yet men have turned it into this rules-based, like, games, you know? So I created these curriculums that were completely different than what they – so they had done – they came in, and my students had learned one, two, three – God only knows what this is. This is completely different. Everything you've done up to this point has nothing to do with that. And it was very, very successful. We did some great shows, and I was teaching sketch writing from a different perspective and different books and more of an English music hall feel to it. And going back to the original Second City stuff of using commedia and improv to script and things like that, which is the Second City has abandoned. Mm. And so when it was over, I had a very, very successful class, and I'm still friends with Michael to this day. And then the administrator asked for my syllabus. And Michael Gelman, God bless him, we're on the phone, and he said, absolutely not. This guy wrote two syllabuses. Or they're his. He says, you don't send them anything. And this is the artistic director of the company saying, no, that would not be fair for somebody who had to create a syllabus in a very short period of time, a week. Handing it over to the Second City would mean the Second City owns it.
Yeah.
And he was really cool about it. And that was the basis. That was the toe for that work. Now, the Second City then left New York.
Yeah.
They pulled back into Chicago. They don't do stuff in New York anymore. And what they left behind was the company that had been hosting them, which was Artistic New Directions. And we took that stuff that I had created, and that's what we've been doing for the last 12 years and continually growing on it. And, you know, as my students are now teaching – and so that it's just this great big generational evolution of stuff. That was, wow, I got excited.
Yeah, no, it's great. The idea of the evolution, like that when Second City decided they weren't going to be in New York anymore, like you guys weren't like, well, I guess that's it. You were like, okay, well, we're going to do our own thing. And that's really wonderful that the community like stuck around and stuck together and kept it going. It's really important for that kind of stuff to happen. And it's important for stories like that to be out there, because another thing about the cycles of life is that I find, especially with theater people, that theater people, I mean, a lot of us are down and excited for the gig to gig situation. It's like, okay, I work on this project. We all are best friends during the project. We have a wonderful run of shows. When it's over, we say goodbye. Maybe I talk to them. I see them around. I do the next project. The next project, I get deeply involved with everybody. I get involved in this. You know what I mean? It's like, that's the way I live my life. I live it event to event, project to project. And very recently, the theater that I started with in Austin also sort of crumbled and went away. And the community came together to make, a theater again. And it was very nice, because it was like, it's not just, we aren't just going to be like, okay, well, that was a good time. See you later. Instead, it was like, okay, well, let's evolve what we are and start a new project with all of us that have been together, and then keep it going. And I was like, oh, this is good. Okay, this is nice. It's new. It's different. It's got different direction, different leadership, but a lot of the same people get to stay together. It creates a family atmosphere. You know, those kinds of things are nice. Between never talking to the people that you spend all this time with and, you know, keeping long-term relationships, I don't know, maybe I'm old, but I like long-term relationships now.
Well, interestingly, I think that it's the theater world is resetting itself to what it's supposed to be. It wasn't until really World War I that the hierarchy of a producer, always in those days, a man, that the producer was at the top of that hierarchy, and that then there was a director, and then there were the artists, who I consider the artists, the writer, the creative artists, and the actors, the interpretive artists. That's not that old. That's only since all of the, like, an entire generation got killed in World War I. Before that, artists went out and found a producer. Artists went out and hired a director, so that the producer facilitated the art being created. The director actually did that thing, just directed. One of the things that broke my spirit as an actor here was heavy-handed directors that have a vision. And you're going, dude, let me interpret it a little bit. I think we're in a period of reset right now, where the actors and the creative types are starting to take over again, because let's admit it, the producers have dropped the ball. There's fewer theaters now than ever before. And that's been this period from 1914 till now. We've watched the theater die through a patriarchal hierarchy. Whereas if the artists take it over again, when the artist co-ops start hiring producers and directors, I think we'll see it actually start to get healthy again.
I think the most diseased part, unfortunately for you, I guess, is New York and LA, though. Both of those systems have been entrenched in a, you know, heavy business, like, if you don't do it my way, you're never going to be famous in this town kind of situation. But smaller towns, I'm finding, because I'm doing a lot of interviews with people all over, I think that you're right. And it's happening in smaller towns, that, like, small towns are coming together, especially with improv, because improv is something that you can read a book about and then figure out with your friends. And also it's something that has a sort of positive nature. It has a sort of, like, you know, be cool with what happens and be nice to each other. At the end of the day, that's kind of, those are the only rules. They're like, be nice, cool. And then just be cool with what your friends say. Like, whatever their idea is, don't judge it. Just do it. Be cool.
Right.
So it's like there's a kindness that we are lacking. And also, I have a theory that the reason why improv is so relevant now is because we've lost religion. So we need something to bring us together in a communal space. And we used to have God, but God's kind of quiet, so we don't dig on that. Now it's more like, how about instead we hang out in basements and throw ideas around and tell each other we're nice, and then we feel good and we go home. And that's, I mean, for at least 10 years of living here in Austin, every Sunday night was you know, doing rehearsals and doing improv jams. It was my church.
Yeah.
I would go there in the morning, rehearse all day, and then finish with a jam, you know, with students, and then come home. And it was like, great. Some people go to their church and, you know, help the priest and clean stuff up and then hand out coffee and donuts to the parishioners and tell everyone they're nice. And that's about the same, you know,
well,
and
church and
go ahead.
Yeah. Well, just, I 100% agree with that, because church and theater have been intertwined for 5,000 years. I mean, the church was a way to tell our stories.
Yeah.
And I mean, they, if you look at it from a technical aspect, there's very little difference between a theater and a church.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Also the kinds of stories. I mean, we're still doing Shakespeare. No, even Shakespeare wouldn't have thought we'd be still be doing Shakespeare. And same, same with the Bible writers. Like, they're writing this down going like, nobody's going to read this. Just write it down. Just write it down. Keep writing. Keep writing. You can do this, John. Come on. You know? It's like, what happened then? I don't know. Just come on, man. Oh, I got it. I got it. You know?
Yeah.
These are just dudes that wrote some stuff.
Yeah.
And then we took it and ran with it for a super long time. And now we want to write our own stories. So we have improv. So we can write and rewrite our stories over and over and over.
I think it's so vitally important to have stories, topical, local stories being told. It's why when I agree with you 100% that some of the most exciting stuff is being done in smaller towns where it's not packaged and sold to a national audience. But that machinery that's happening in New York and LA is crumbling of its own under its own weight in itself. Because they're coming to people who are doing their own thing. They see a successful show running and it's happening, and they say, well, who's the writer of that? And once upon a time, they would then take that writer and say, write this way, packaged for the entire nation, and here is all the money in the world. And now what's happening is they're saying, write our stuff our way, packaged for the entire world, but they're not going to pay the money. And so you see more and more creative types here in New York and out in LA that say, it's not worth it to me to abandon that which I am passionate about for the little bit of money. If I'm gonna sell out, like if I'm gonna whore myself, I want to be an expensive whore.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely.
There's nothing worse than selling out cheap, and that's really what they ask for now. Whereas, even we have access to the world, we have access to the internet now. So I'm hopeful. I believe that it's gonna. I 100% agree with you that it started in the smaller towns and the smaller cities where people are saying, the hell with you, I'm just going to do my thing and tell my story. And I think that's infected the big centers too. And we're also saying, the hell with you, we're doing our own thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I hope that you're right, that the epicenters are changing in their way. I mean, if anything else, like the fact that Atlanta is a big TV and film hub now, I think really adjusts the like high horse that Los Angeles thought they were on. Like Los Angeles was like, yeah, if you want to be on TV, you come here and deal with it. And now it's like, or you could go to Atlanta, which is kind of nice and not as expensive to live in. And also maybe there are more opportunities because fewer people are moving there. Maybe. Like
our,
I don't know.
Corollary to that. Oh, sorry. But our corollary to that is Broadway, which nothing interesting is happening in Broadway really anymore. And by that I mean people from here, we don't go there. If we go and see something, it's because, my wife and I went and saw The Constitution and What It Means to Me because it was a different, weird little show. It wasn't $150 a ticket, So we'll go see something like that. But those mega shows, nobody who lives here sees those. They go and they find the off Broadway spaces, cabaret. People go to improv. As crazy as it sounds, you do. You know, there's people at the Pit. There's people at the Magnet, UCB. People are going to see stuff.
Oh yeah.
Because they crave something that's not that.
Yeah.
So the center of our world, the people who are here making, who are creative, know that that's crap. But King Kong? King Kong? King Kong. King Kong.
You know what, though? The trouble is, the spectacle is not as spectacle as it used to be. Like, the other day, I was watching the Lego movie, and I was like, how are we not all talking about this every day? How are we not all, like, shaking every one of their hands to say, like, I can't believe you made that thing? Like,
yeah.
We are so inundated with amazing things that people do, whether they're professional theater people or not. People on the internet are doing stuff so much that even the most amazing thing is not amazing to us anymore. We are not amazed.
Here is the amazing thing that improv does. And that's, you've touched on something that I say while I'm teaching. I tell my students not to do the spectacular because we cannot compete with movies. And as an example, I give Spider-Man the musical. Right? We cannot compete with movies. We can't have explosions. We can't have real aliens. We can't have space battles. We can act those things out, but it's almost pointless. What we can do is include the audience in our creative process. And I'll tell you what, that's the best damn deal in entertainment. you're gonna yell up something, and I'm going to interpret it, and between the bunch of us, we're going to have group mind and create something together for $5. I mean, that's a hell of a deal.
Yeah.
And that's our niche. That's how we give people an experience that they walk away and they go, wow, that changed me. That they said my words and then they pulled stuff right out of their butts and it was better than, you hear this all the time. I'm sure you hear this all the time. That was better than the last play I saw. That was better than the last movie I saw.
Yeah.
Of course it was, because you're part of it.
Communal experiences is kind of what I think is what's bringing together the theater in the smaller towns. People are distant from each other with the internet and with their jobs and with, you know, even back to my, you know, cycle theory. People don't know who they're. They don't have friends anymore. They don't feel connected to stuff. They're at a weird point in their cycle. They're like, what am I doing with my life? They don't know. But communal experience, they want to talk to other human beings. It's the one thing we will keep going back to over and over and over. And that's why, I don't know, I keep staying in live theater. I always laugh at myself because every time I get a chance to do other things, I do it, and then I come back to live theater. And it's like, why can't I quit you? Cruel mistress with 60 seats in the audience. Come on, man.
60? Well, that's amazing. Cause I
Is that a lot?
We've done some stuff in basements of bars that have been condemned. The stages where they used to keep the garbage. It's like, can we somehow take all of the broken chairs in the back and piece together 15 seats? when we do stuff, you shoot it and you put it on YouTube, right? You just throw it up there. It's not even edited. You just throw that up there. And you get hundreds of people watch it, you know, because there's people that are craving stuff. And there were 6 people in that audience. You know, you do the thing that you do to create a community of, you know, 6 improvisers and 6 audience members and 200 people, 300 people on the internet watch it because they crave that. I wish I was there. But I'm in Toronto. It's powerful.
Yeah. So what's your jam right now? What's the thing that you're telling your students? And maybe we've already touched on it, but like, what's the thing that you're, that you've been thinking about that's your, like, improv has taught me this, or, you know how, like, I don't know about you, but like, I teach the same classes over and over, right? So each time I teach them, I have a different kind of angle just to keep it interesting for myself. Or something's happened in my own life, and so then I'm like, that makes me think about this, and it frames everything that's going on in the class. In the class that you're teaching right now, what's the thing? What's the thing that you keep coming back to that you're talking about, that you're, that's in your brain as an, as a creative?
That improvisation is a simple thing that's hard to do. And it came about because I was teaching a drop-in. And drop-ins in New York are a unique experience. So we were doing something. I had given, you know, we had gotten a location. For me, location is a, is an active and positive activity that you can do in that location. So I have them doing an activity. And every time they started speaking, they stopped doing their activity. And I said, you know, I would never hire an improviser because they can't talk and work at the same time. I don't know of a single job I've ever had where I didn't talk to the person beside me while working. And somebody in the drop-in said, it's too hard. And I said, okay, then let's stop improvising and let's do juggling instead. Grab any three objects that you see and let's juggle them. And the guy said, I don't know how to juggle. I said, why don't you know how to juggle? Why can't you juggle? Well, it's because you haven't practiced. Well, all we're doing here is practicing. And it's a simple thing, but it's hard to do. How do you win a gold medal in the Olympics in track and field? You simply run faster than everyone else on the planet. Nice, simple answer. But getting to that simple answer is practice.
How do you get to Carnegie Hall?
Practice, practice, practice.
Exactly.
And so getting people to, because they often get frustrated. You show up in the class. What I teach is, you know, these three principles from Elaine May. They're very positive and they're very simple. And then when people bang their head against the wall because they can't get it, you got to slow them down and say, it's simple, but it ain't easy.
Totally.
I'm fascinated too by people who come into improv because they're too lazy to be actors.
I know. I hate that. When they're like, well, I figured I didn't want to have to learn lines. I was like, get out of here. This is not a no rehearsal situation.
So you're going to have to practice 3-4 times a week, which I do not have to do in between plays.
Yeah.
Right? It's actually so much more work to do this thing that is so much simpler that I have very little patience for that now. Although I don't yell at people. I try to be as gentle as I can. Sometimes I have yelled at people, but very rarely.
I love noobs. I love a person who comes in, doesn't know what it is, wants to talk about it. Oh, I love them so much. I love showing them the magic, and then I love demystifying the magic. That's how I run.
Yeah.
I show them the magic. I show them they can do it. I get a couple of exercises that anybody can do. When you do it, you like feel like $1 million. That's how they come back after the first class. And then I demystify the magic. And then I go, hey, remember that? This is how you do it.
Do you know any actual magicians?
Like, personally, no. I mean, I watch a lot of magic, but I don't know. Like, I've never talked to anybody. They're not the coolest people in the world. Yeah, I know. But I'm kind of uncool myself. And also, like, I I find comfort in structure. So like when I teach sketch, yeah, I'm always talking about structure because I find that if you can explain a basic framework, it makes it easier for people to put their ideas in. And then once you create a framework, they can put their ideas in, then read through it, and then edit it from there. And then it works out. So I try to put ideas of frameworks into people's heads when they're doing improv. And yeah, like when they finish level one, I'm going to go, okay, all that stuff I said, forget it. Don't worry about it. You don't have to do that anymore.
Yep.
But it's like scaffolding. Like I set up the side. I make sure this side stays up and this side stays up and you can still do it. You know, I'm holding the strings. You're the puppet. But then I let you know that I'm holding the strings and you're like, what? And then I let go of the strings.
You know, it's similar in sketch. When I'm teaching it, I have a framework. You know, you want to have your premise. You want to have your point of view. I'm going to ask you whose point of view this is coming from. If it was a joke being told in the bar, who's telling the joke, right? And I need to have an author's message by the end, and break it down. And I essentially hand them a framework, and I say, do that. And then a couple of times I'm happy to say I've hired some of my students to actually write something. And they say, can I show you my premise chart? And I say, fuck no, you can show me the sketch. Sorry about the language.
Oh, you're fine.
I was so good up to this point.
No, you're good. I'm fine. Doesn't matter.
All of that stuff was just bullshit that I taught you so that you could learn how to write a sketch. Now just sit down and write a sketch.
Well, if it works for you, great, but I don't want to see the beginning. I want to see the end now. Yeah, it's like, great, if you do that every time, go ahead, but that's not my part now. Well, because I made like a Mad Libs. I teach kids. I do a middle school comedy camp and a high school comedy camp. Uh-huh. Every summer for the past couple of years. And so I've turned sketch comedy. I've got like little Mad Libs to show them certain frameworks. And then we play a couple of improv games to get them in the mindset of what I'm looking for. So like, for instance, I teach them straight versus absurd by doing this exercise called, well, what happened was. And what happens is there's three of them who are employees and one of them who's the boss. And they have to improv a little scene where the boss tells them something terrible they did at the job. And the three employees have to work together to justify why that was actually the right thing to do. So they're like, hey, guys, I just got back to McDonald's and here at the store, all of the fries are everywhere. The whole place is filled with it. And then the kids have to come up with like a reason why they think it's a good thing that there's fries everywhere. And they're like, so you've seen bouncy houses, right? What about a fry house? We had people here. It was great. Like they come up with fun ideas, you know? Yeah. And then they'll always turn to me like while they're doing it. And they're like, isn't this weird that no one would say that? And I was like, it's not about that. Just be crazy. It's wild. Believe it. People want to dance in fries. If they want to dance in fries, what other things do they want to do? And then somebody will be like, yeah, we had a ketchup fountain and people were dancing underneath the ketchup like it was a shower. And I was like, exactly. Yep. What else? Like just to make craziness. And then I'm like, okay, the boss is straight and you guys are absurd. It's one idea versus another idea. And then they're like, cool. And then I make them go write scenes that are like that. I get a lot of boss and employee scenes, sure. But I can easily be like, make that a dad and some siblings and you're in, like, or whatever, you know?
They're universal stories.
Right. And that's the beauty part about it. Like, I'm just a nerd for structures. That's why I have my little stuff like that. But like, I don't know. I love teaching. I think it's a great thing. And I think that it's wonderful that you're working with these level zeros, these like, and by that I mean the like drop-in class, that's what we called it, the zero, the drop-in classes to get people in and part of the program. Are you currently working then in the, is it the Ensemble Theater?
So yeah, so I work with Ant Theater and
Theater, just Ant.
Ant Theater, all one word, and doing my own, because they're not structurally large enough to be able to facilitate my classes. So I'm just okay. So I got my own thing, and I run their resident improv company called the Ensemble.
I get it. Yeah.
It's funny. And we'll do their drop-ins, their drop-in classes. But then, you know, when people want to get a little bit more serious, then they'll come to my classes on Saturdays, which are pretty cool.
Awesome.
It's nice working with an ensemble that have been together for a long time, because we'll get a gig. You know, we were talking about writing. We'll get a gig, and I'll ask somebody to write something for it. And they hand it, and then they say, "Do you got any feedback?" And you go, "Nope. This is a great sketch. This is a brilliant sketch. This is what a professional. This is how professionals write. And you're getting paid for it. And this is it. This is the big time, kid. And it's perfect." And they look at you, and but don't you want to? I need some feedback. Well, your feedback is great work. Here's some money. Here's some more feedback. Money. And you go, "Oh, cool." So that's an amazing journey to take, and then to let those people know that they now need to pass it on. Once they're doing work, like I'll watch some of them improvise, and I'll sit in the back of the room and laugh. And they go, "You got any notes?" And I go, "Nope. That's as good as it gets. So you got to get out there and start teaching, because you gotta pass this shit on, man. You're perfect." I don't want to say man, because it's not man. I'm trying to remove gender as much as I can. I'm trying to remove gender from my language. Refer to people by their name, and they and them. It's healthy. I think it's healthier.
I know people don't like it everywhere, but I like to call everyone sir. Man, woman, doesn't matter. It's fine. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir. I don't know. I ask people to change how they say things all the time.
Sure.
You know, somebody asks a question and I get them to delve into, what are you trying to say with that question? Right? You know, what is the statement that's behind that question? And make them talk differently. And if I can ask other people to do it, then I should be able to do it too. Now, my brain plasticity is not what it once was.
But if you're trying, it shows.
And, you know, it doesn't offend anybody when I refer to the person by their name.
Yeah.
And then I can say, you said this, and they said that, and then we did this, and we all laughed when you did that thing and they responded. It's pretty easy to take the gender out.
That's a good one.
Makes a couple of people more comfortable, then yay.
Yeah, right? Why not?
Wow, how did that sentence start?
You're trying to make the world a better place, and that's what's nice.
I'm trying.
Yeah.
I'm trying not to. Because in the second section of my life, I did not make it a better place, because I was one of those boys, you know, I was one of those that I can't stand. That's why I say I would have fired me too. You know, I was absolutely a bulldozer on stage and used people as props to get to my next funny. I didn't really listen to people. I listened to everything that was said to me as a setup for something. Not to, as Del Close said, listening is not enough. We listen to understand. And if that doesn't lead to a joke, well, then let's have one fewer jokes in this scene.
Yeah.
And I wasn't, I was terrible in that second quarter. So I spent so much of the third section that I now am told that I'm leaving. I spent so much of that third section trying to just right some of my own wrongs.
You know, in the world that we're in right now, there's a lot of people getting called out for their bad behavior when they were younger. And while some of it is terrible behavior, and they certainly need to be called out for it on it for sure, I do think that sometimes we can chalk it up to the level they're at, the journey they're on. Like, what is it that they're doing? Like, am I going to be mad if a 22-year-old guy insults me? No. Why? He's 22. He's an idiot. He doesn't know what he's doing.
I think
it's fine.
I think,
and I get that you're right that, you know, people are sensitive, and that if I can do anything to make those sensitive people feel better, I should do that.
Right.
But I'm also a little harder and a little rougher. And so I'm always like, hey, I want you to get through your journey. And I want everyone to become a great person, right, of course. But I think we have to allow that sometimes you have to be a jerk to learn why not to be a jerk.
Right. So here I am. I'm now teaching and directing. And I'm asking actors to be vulnerable, even in improv. Because if you see the style of improv, that the improvisational theater is what I call it. I don't use the improv word. I call it improvisational theater because I'm asking them to actually connect about real stuff and have real emotions and have moments that lead to a deeper funny that is so amazing. So I'm asking those actors to be vulnerable. I have to protect them. That's my job as a teacher and a director, is to like a lion, like a lioness, I got to protect them so that they can be vulnerable and they can fail and nobody's going to make fun of them, certainly not me. And I do want to go back to that second section, Scotty, that wasn't like that, and how I'm trying to make up for some of that. I think that when older people, usually men, get called out on their earlier behavior, it's the response to that moment that's the problem. The response from me has often, the thing that I've learned in section three was to say, yeah, I did that. Here's what I learned, how my behavior affected others, and how my behavior held other people back without even advancing my own position. It was a lose-lose. My behavior was a lose-lose. It wasn't like you lost and I won. We both lost. And I learned this. I am sorry. And I think I have changed. And that's not what I hear when people get caught doing stuff when they were 20.
No, you're right. I mean, a lot of people don't deal well with that. And I think that's part of what our job is to teach people too. Because we teach a lot of people that are not intending to be theater people. I mean, like, there's a lot of people in my classes that are not going to be on SNL ever. And not because they're not trying, but just because, like, you know, they have a different job, but they want to take an improv class. And so I think I always try to teach an openness, try to teach love whatever your scene partner is bringing to the table and embrace it like it was your idea, and try to do that with everything in your life. When someone brings something to you, just be nice about it. You don't have to live with it forever. The scene will be over. That dinner with your parents will be over. That awkward conversation will be over. Just be good in that moment. Go with whatever they're talking about. If they come over and they say to you for the millionth time at your, you know, family dinner, oh, how's the stand-up going? How's that? And you're like, well, I don't actually do stand-up. It's kind of different. It's a situation. No, I get it. I get it. You like the SNL kids. I get it. Yeah, yeah, it's great. So do you tell any jokes about me? Instead of getting mad like we all do when our family wants to know if somehow we're making fun of them, but in a fun way that they'll like, we can just play along and pretend you're an improv scene with them. And then it's like, Yeah, the crowd loves it. I'm like, Aunt Mildred, she puts them back. And then everybody gets a good laugh, and you don't actually have to do that joke ever. And but she feels good, and she goes back to work the next day, and she goes, you know, my nephew, who's a comedian, does jokes about me, because I'm amazing. Best day of her life. Best day of her life.
Well, that's similar to, so here you are in a level zero, and there's people from all walks of life, right? But, and they can be the most musclehead bro ever. They still chose to take an improv class. And there's, what, 12 of us in the room, maybe? Good class? 4 of us when it's not a good class? But they still chose to do this. And there's hundreds of thousands of people watching some kind of sports event right now. So when I get a new class, the first thing I tell them is that they're weird. You are weird. You're more sensitive than the other kids.
Yep.
You think differently than the other kids.
Mm-hmm.
You often say things that people look at you like, what? And let me tell you something. They're the ones that don't get it because you're weird and you're sensitive and you're here. You're a demographic too small to measure. There's 6 people in an improv class and 600,000 people in a stadium. I don't think that's what stadiums hold. I don't know. I don't do sports. But there's tens of thousands of people. I got a stadium in my, like, right close to us. And there's thousands and thousands of people going there. And they're not sensitive. I know because they're driving Hummers. They're the bros, right? Even the bros in an improv class are the more sensitive people. They're weird and they're wonderful and they're finding their people. And I'm not kidding when I say it, the people that do improv are a demographic too small to measure. Think about it like golf. At least golf has its own cable channel.
Nobody wants improv to have its own cable channel, though. You really don't want that.
Don't you? I totally do.
No.
I think that my fourth section might be starting the improv cable channel.
Mm-mm. And New York City still has like city TV stations, by the way. You could totally do it.
Yeah, we do. We do. But I think a dedicated part of your cable package. Do you want the improv channel?
No.
Why not?
I just don't like it. I just don't like filming improv. I think part of what improv is like we were talking about before. It's the immediate exchange. It's the being in the room. It's like being there. It's like you can watch the people on the sides. You can see what's going on between them. You can see them get nervous. They don't know what they're going to say. Oh my God. Like there's just something about being in the physical space with improvisers that makes it better. I often tell my students that they are having the best time doing improv because it's a great art form to do, but it's harder for the audience to enjoy as much of it as they are. So they have to do as much as they can to make the audience enjoy it as much as they are. You know how much fun you're having? They're just watching your fun. You need to bring them in to your fun. And so,
and
yeah.
And yet. So on the other side, I tell my students when you're doing a show, you shoot it, you do it on Facebook Live, you put it on YouTube. Because, okay, I say I'm from Toronto. I'm not from Toronto. I'm from a little town 45 minutes north of Toronto. It's just easier to say I'm in Toronto. Just like it's easier to say I'm in New York because I work every day in New York. I live in New Jersey. It's just – I wasn't in Toronto. I was in this little town, and there was nothing, man. There was 3 channels. There was 3 television stations. There were 3 television channels when I was a kid.
I remember.
Was CBC in English and in French. Right. So, my French is terrible, so I couldn't really watch the French station. And there was one CFTO, a Toronto station. This is when I'm a little kid. And Saturday nights, that television was turned to the hockey game, which I hate. I hate hockey. Family watched the hockey game together. And then somewhere, my dad, probably at a fire, got this little portable television with a UHF hoop on it. And I don't even know where it was coming from, but I could get the sound, not the picture, but the sound from a comedy club. And it was a big one. So it might have been somebody actually told me that because I know it was the Improv, and there was an Improv in New York at the time. And Bud Friedman made sure that all of those went on cable access. So it might have been New York, but if the stratosphere was right, it might have been bouncing all the way from L.A. I don't know. I don't know anything about that. But I do know that I was a little kid. I'm talking about 7 years old. And I was listening to a single camera feed in the back of a comedy club. And I felt like – and I knew that the world was a bigger thing. I knew that there was hope that there were other weird, sensitive people out there. So – I always tell my students, you gotta shoot everything, and you put it out on the internet, and there's sad, lonely people are gonna watch it, and they're gonna say, "Hey, maybe I'm not so lonely."
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
And then surely somebody's gonna come along with some kind of like VR helmet so that they can watch my cable network and enjoy it like they're in the audience.
That's true.
I don't know.
These days,
something.
Yeah. that's real. That's legit. That's like a conference call. That's where you're really there. Man, that's amazing. That's something we gotta find that technology.
Yeah, it's gotta exist. Some smarter people than I will figure it out.
So listen, Scotty, thank you so much for taking 2 hours out of your night to talk to me.
Oh,
I can't believe this conversation has been 2 hours long. This is wild. I haven't had a podcast this long in forever, but you have been a joy, an absolute joy to talk to. And I feel like I could ask you like 1,000 more things. So in 6 months or a year, I'm probably going to call you back for another one.
Been to Austin. I have never been to Austin before.
Oh, my God. Yeah, you do. You definitely, definitely do. It's a crazy improv town. There are 5 long form and 1 short form theater.
I gotta come.
There's so much.
And I will be the most important part. I will come and be a paying member of the audience.
I thought you were going to be like, I will be a New York City teacher. I was like, yeah, you'll be pretty important.
No, I think the most important person, of course, is the person who paid their $5 and sitting in the audience. Because I love improv. I watch it. I adore it.
You're amazing.
I think it's amazing. You're amazing.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.